Welcome to After Party Pod. I'm your host, Anna David. I'm so excited about the guest that we have today. I'm mildly obsessed with her. I think I told her several times throughout the episode. She handled it, I would say, well, honestly. Her name is Claudia Lano. She was an actress and is now an extremely successful writer and TV producer. She played Diana on Knott's Landing. You all remember that. She was on it from 1979 to 1984, as in, like, while I was watching, not Knott's Landing, I was watching more like Fantasy Island and The Love Boat, which she guest starred on, by the way. So she did that for a long time. And then she, I mean, to hear her tell it at all bottom, she, you know, everything went terribly, and then she ended up creating a television show called Rude Awakening, starring Sherilyn Fenn, that was on Showtime from 1998 to 2001, and it was all about being sober, an actress struggling with sobriety. And so that happened. Then she was on a bunch of other shows, including she's the half-sister of the actor Michael Rapaport. They did a Fox show together called The War at Home. She was on Accidentally on Purpose. And then last year, she created, wrote, and produced the ABC sitcom How to Live with Your Parents for the Rest of Your Life, which starred Sarah Chalkin, Brad Garrett, and Elizabeth Perkins. Now, that's based on her life. I went to interview her and in the home of her parents. She moved back home with her parents when she thinks it all fell apart. I think of her life as incredible. Oh God, I'm doing that embarrassing thing in the intro. Jesus, I'm not, because I, you know, am working on acceptance, I am actually not going to stop and re-record. But what I'm going to tell you is that that show was great. I do not like shows like that. I loved this show. And it was really just the story of her life brought to ABC, which was amazing. Unfortunately, the show is no longer, she's fine. She's on another show, the new Sean Hayes show. Meanwhile, she is 28 years sober. And I think just an incredibly inspiring, incredibly smart, incredibly honest woman who may block me on Twitter now that she listens to this introduction. Anyway, the theme song you heard is by Seth Rothschild, sung by The Patients. I'm Anna David. You're about to hear Claudia Lano. I love you guys for listening. Thank you.
Is like we're recording. And was that so?
No, that's not so hard.
Maybe I just made it look easy.
You do. You make everything look
easy. Oh, isn't that the truth? Okay, so as I was telling you.
Yes.
My experience, my awareness of you, okay, started. So I was in the worst part of my addiction. Like, holed up for years, doing cocaine, writing nonsensical garbage. Amidst the writing of the nonsensical, I do know how to speak, garbage, I wrote this really good spec for Sex and the City. It was like one of these rare moments where I did it. It got sent out and I had real meetings. Mm-hmm. And I was like so out of my mind. But the real meeting where there was an actual job available, where I saw the show and I'm like, oh my God, I could write on the show, was your show.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. It was truly exciting and surreal. So that was Rude Awakening.
Right.
And this was a show that was all about a woman in LA trying to be sober.
Yes, it was. Well, you know, first of all, how that came about was so crazy.
Okay, tell me.
At the time that I wrote Rude Awakening, I had left my ex-husband.
Right.
My daughter, I guess at that time, was about 3 or 4. I had been living with my parents for a couple of years with nothing. I mean,
right.
Not a pot to piss in. I kept my money in a coffee can. We were sleeping on the floor. My bottom that I had was almost nothing compared, at least financially, to this bottom.
How long were you sober at that point?
I was sober 12 years, 14 years.
Wow.
12
okay.
or 14 years. And I had finally made a little bit of headway, not in terms of, I had made a tiny bit of headway in terms of writing, which had never been my original goal, but which I had been working on throughout my sobriety, I guess is the only word.
Right.
Underneath still pursuing acting.
Right.
And, you know, I had written a spec.
Like, so a spec TV?
Rude Awakening was a spec pilot.
Right.
I didn't have an agent. I had sort of pitched it or talked about it to Joe Voci, who...
Who's that?
He was an executive at a production company, Mandalay. And my friend, Andrea Abbott, they had made a pilot together, and that's how I met him. And that was my first room experience, was helping on Andrea's pilot.
Okay, which was what?
I think that one was, that was called Totally Cool.
Okay, and so in UPN. Helping on that, you, oh my God, remember UPN?
Yeah.
So in helping on that, you were like, oh, television, you got, you
well,
know,
I had already been trying. I'd written a bunch of, I just couldn't, I didn't have any business acumen.
Right.
And I, my sense of myself and the way I thought other people saw me, which may honestly have been accurate, was I was a failed actress and a mediocre comic whose stepfather owned the club that I performed in.
Okay, what club?
The Improv.
That man I just met owned the Improv, but he still owns the Improv.
He's Bud Friedman's partner. They own the Improv worldwide.
Okay.
And my mother was a comic.
Right.
And I had been on a television show and hung out at the Improv every night and knew what all in the middle of the comedy boom. It was a great time.
Okay, wait, but you're going way too fast.
Yes.
Okay, so you were on Knott's Landing.
Yes, I was
not
on
just
Knott's
on
Landing.
A television show, but you were on it for
on Knott's Landing
years and
for
years
six
and years.
Years. Anyway, so by the time I'm sleeping on my parents' floor,
yes,
I have come up with an idea for my early sobriety experience.
Right.
About a former nighttime soap opera actress who gets sent to, we called it Addictions Anonymous, by the court.
Right, right.
And I told Joe about it, and he said, you should go home and write that, which is sort of a way for people to say, well, I'm buying you lunch, and I'll continue to talk to you, but there's nothing I can do for
right,
you.
Right, right.
Well, I did. I would write it at night after my daughter went to sleep, you know, and I was working as Andrea Abbott's personal assistant her house, like picking up her son. I mean, I did, you know, picking up her son.
Dry cleaning,
returning
marketing,
her Victoria's
maybe.
Secrets
catalog,
purchases, calling around to, well, I won't say that. Although it's very funny.
I know that.
So, at night, and I'm pretty much writing about my first year of sobriety. Well, my first, how this happened. Not me, a fictionalized version of me and a fictionalized version of my parents.
Mm-hmm.
If I had been more famous and if I were more messed up.
Right,
basically
right.
Exaggerating.
Right.
I was not that famous and honestly... I didn't do that many bad things, and I got sober very young. So there wasn't that much stuff to do.
Right, right. But
I hung out at a bar every night. I had things.
Yes,
I had things, and I had, I believe, a persona. So I sent the first act to Joe, and he says, it's great, keep going. In the middle of this, I declare bankruptcy. I get in a car accident on the way to declare bankruptcy and run into the room. I had just put my head through the windshield.
Oh my God!
With blood streaming down, because if you didn't get there in time, I mean, my life was hectic.
Yes.
Finish it. Send it in to Joe. He takes it out because he was a great producer without anybody saying you can do that.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, I have this Showtime is interested, and all these people are interested, and my home number's on the script.
Right.
People are calling me. I didn't have any clothes. I had to go to these meetings. I wore my mom's clothes.
Right.
All my clothes were, you know, crappy, and I mean, I hadn't been nobody gave crap about me for many, many, many years.
Right.
I mean, many years. That's why it's amazing.
Yeah.
Who could hang in that long? I don't recommend it.
Right.
Say give
but you
up.
Had no, I mean,
I had no choice.
Yeah.
I hadn't gone to college. I really didn't know what I was going to do.
You didn't go ever.
No, I was on television.
Yeah. That was your college.
So I, you know, I didn't have anything to fall back on.
Yeah.
And I'm living with my parents and I have a kid.
Yeah.
And anyway, all of a sudden, you know, one thing led to another, and Joe Fauci, who's a brilliant producer, said to Showtime, you know, you can't just pick this up as a pilot. You have to pick up 13 episodes. I don't know. You know, and they said, well, what are they? She has to come in and tell us what the first season is. Joe said, you have to come up with what the first season of this series is. And I did, and that was my first pitch meeting. Was I'm with every executive at Showtime wearing my mom's suit.
Did Andrea help you? Was it just you?
We talked about it, but no, I think I mean, she helped me a lot in my career, but for this, this was, I basically pitched a bunch of, you know, my first year of sobriety.
Right.
And, you know, mixed and matched a bunch of crap together, and they really, they loved the script. So I think the main thing that occurred to me in the middle of the meeting is, look, this is a very, nobody has, I mean, this, it was ahead of its time.
Yes.
It was very low budget, so it never quite came out, it never really
looked the way you wanted,
the way
it to.
Wanted it to. But there was no heroine like this on television.
No.
Or had ever been.
And by the way, I would argue that still today, yes, it is a storyline in a lot of things, but there's, are there heroines that are like struggling with sobriety?
Well, I think it wasn't just that she was struggling with sobriety. She was unlikable in a lot of ways. She was deeply flawed.
Right.
And
right.
making, you know, and trying to improve herself, but she was coming from an incredibly flawed place.
Right, right.
And that first thing, you know, it was really, she's just doing one bad thing after another.
Right.
And, you know, it was the thing, it's about redemption, you know.
Right.
And but, so you've got to, something's got to be bad at the beginning. But I thought, in the middle of the meeting, I thought, you know what, if they like me, they'll think this is possible.
Right.
And they liked me.
Right.
So I said, I'm a likable person, I guess.
Right.
So I know how to make this, you know, and this is my story, sort of. I think I know how to make this, you know, I don't know what the hell happened, but I walked out of that, and now I had just created a show that was going into its first season.
And, wow.
And
could that happen today with the 13 episodes and the person who's never been on a show?
Yeah, it can happen today, but it's still very rare.
Yeah,
you know,
but
I
it
mean,
was rare then, too.
It was, I think it was
unheard
almost, you know, beyond rare. I mean, the things I had going for me was I was cheap.
Right, right, right.
You know?
I mean,
you could get me for a song. I had just declared bankruptcy. So
right.
I had, you know, what do I know? And I didn't know any better to ask for, you know, to know what an insane proposition this whole thing was.
Right. And it was before Showtime's golden age, for
it was,
sure.
Yeah, it was in between the Hot Tub Hollywood Showtime and Weeds Showtime.
Right.
You know, that first season, well, the first two seasons, second season was a little bit more fraught, but you know, was I unlike anything, nothing has been like that. It was beyond incredible.
So, okay, and it was Sherilyn Fenn played, you know, your alter ego.
Yeah, Sherilyn Fenn, Lynn Redgrave played her mom.
Right.
Jonathan Penner played the sort of, can you curse on this?
Oh, yeah, as much
as you
want.
Her best, her fuck buddy, best friend.
Yeah.
Rain Pryor was on, who played another,
like a friend
in, the lesbian roommate of Jonathan Penner. And Tim Curry was on for a while. My stepfather was on. Roger Daltrey, Beverly D'Angelo. I mean, we had some really cool people on the show. You know, we really did. It was,
and so when you were, and you, so you were talking about recovery and sobriety and relapse and all these things that were not part of our vernacular at the time. What years were, this was 98?
This was 98 it started. It
right.
was pretty, it was not, I mean, Larroquette had been on.
Right.
The Michael Keaton movie had come out. And so had Postcards from the Edge. It was not like it was in the 80s.
Right.
People kind of knew.
Right.
I think. You know, and we, it was difficult, you know, because you didn't want to focus so much on lexicon and jargon that you have to keep explaining everything every week. So, but yes, we were, we did, we, I mean, we really did. I mean, we had her struggle with her, you know, her spiritual, I mean, that was a great episode. That was so good. I mean, it was good. It was good. It had real moments of, you know, her, you know, praying and everything. I mean,
I can't, it's hard to imagine even.
Yeah.
And I don't, I mean, this is what I, so my experience.
She was incredible.
Was great.
She really was. I had a more comedic interpretation of the piece and the role, but, you know, she really brought, you know, a depth, and she was pretty game for anything.
Yeah.
I mean, she really was, you know, the kind of actress who throws herself into something and cares deeply about what she's doing.
And she was, that was her first thing, big thing after playing Audrey on
I mean, she had a bunch of different things, and it was, you know, it was pretty risky for her.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it was risky for everybody, but, you know, she, it was remarkable. It was a remarkable experience.
Okay, and so, but so my, so my experience is, so I had this Sex and the City spec that was the only decent thing I'd ever written, and it was the only thing I'd written not on cocaine.
Uh-huh.
There was a, you know, there's some, like, reason, the two items are related. Mm-hmm. And so I had this agent, and they were like, people like this script, we think we can get you staffed with this, and then they were like, we've got a meeting for you. I had a bunch of meetings that work like, it was like weird, like Law and Order, and just things that were clearly not right for mm-hmm. me, and I don't know why the meetings even happened. And I remember so well getting the meeting, and I guess it was with you and Andrea, but I don't remember Andrea. I just remember that I drove somewhere in the valley. Don't even tell me I drove here.
You didn't drive here, but you didn't drive to the valley.
Are you sure I didn't drive to the valley?
I'm positive, because I remember the meeting too, and we didn't shoot in the valley. So we were at Hollywood Center Studios, which is on Santa Monica and Las Palmas.
Granted, I was out of my mind, so anything is totally. This was also the period of time where I was taking like 10 Ambien a night, and so I'd find myself driving during the day, wondering where I was going and why. Uh-huh. So I cannot be trusted.
I don't even think we were living in this house at that time.
What I remember, uh-huh. not that this should mean much, is that I had been up all night doing coke by myself, and I feel like watching the VHS copies of Rude Awakening that I was given was like my first exposure to like recovery and sobriety.
Wow.
And I was like, this is so weird, and this is so threatening, yet this is so appealing. Like, you have no idea this bizarre, crucial role it's played in my life.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, I want to be on this show. And I'm like, and I didn't really have the awareness to know I was an addict or anything like that. And all I remember is that I sat in this room with cocaine drip going down the back of my throat, wanting this job, you know, because also not understanding that my happiness was based on all sorts of things. I thought, you know, you get the job and life gets perfect.
Right.
So I was like, this needs to happen. And I just remember meeting you, and that you were just so, I'm not blowing smoke, but just so cool and beautiful and smart and savvy and sober. And that was just, those did not really compute, you know?
Uh-huh.
And I remember you saying to me, do you know AA? Have you ever been? You asked me something.
Yeah, I asked everybody.
Yeah, exactly. But I was just like, and I remember going, no, horrified and offended, and yet knowing that it was such a just bizarre thing for me. And then I, you know, I didn't get hired, which was a good thing, let's just say, because mm-hmm. I had some more bottoming out to do. And then all I knew is, you know, I ended up getting sober very shortly after that. And one day, and you always like, I was just like, oh, Claudia Lano, she's just like the, you know, that's what can happen if you get sober kind
oh
of a
God.
Thing. Yes. And then one day I was like walking by, like, I don't even know. And you was just like outside, I mean, or something. And you were just like, oh, hey, Anna, are you going in here? So casual. And I'm like, and I have no idea if I made a speech to you then and said, do you understand the role you've played in my life?
I remember seeing you. I think you said something to me. I don't know whether I played a big role, though. That's great to hear, honestly.
It's true.
That's
it's
nice
really
to hear.
True.
Yes.
Okay, so we're done with me.
Okay.
So Rude Awakening is on for 3 seasons?
Yes, it was on for 3 seasons, 55 episodes.
And then?
And then I for a while, Andrew and I partnered up and, you know, we sold a bunch of things. And I really wanted to work on another staff. You know, I did. So we parted ways. She wasn't that interested in that. And I started working on Less Than Perfect, and I was on that for the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And I made other, you know, I was always working on something. I had a short-lived show, which I really loved.
The Jenna Elfman show.
You know, I had another one.
Oh, so what?
It was called
that wasn't true.
Good Girls Don't. It was on the Oxygen Network.
Okay.
That, man, that show was the most fun.
What was it?
Really you know, again, ahead of its time. Ahead of its time.
Yeah.
You know, it was a single camera show, and it was, you know, young people.
Yeah.
You know, it was a fun show. It was a little It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, but more female-centered.
Mm-hmm. Who was in it?
Bree Turner, mm-hmm. Joy Goring, Nicole Hiltz, Kevin Christie, not famous, you know, it was not famous people, Brent King, but it was the most fun. I think that was one of my most fun experiences, because we really did not have a lot of network or studio interference, and I really learned a lot about making a show. You know, it was again low budget, but the technology had changed so much since we did Rude Awakening with single camera shooting and the cameras and the film. We at that time, again, predating things that are on television now, I was bringing in episodes of the English Office and another single camera show from Canada.
How did you know about that?
I don't know, you know, just around, and said, you know, we can shoot like this, and, you know, we didn't have talking into the camera mockumentary, but we did have looking into the camera for no reason. We're just like, well, what can we do that doesn't cost anything that'll just be interesting?
Right.
So we did, every once in a while, a person would kind of look at the camera and go like that. Really had a great time on that show. It was one of my favorite experiences ever.
And how long was that?
That was just 8 episodes.
Okay.
So great. It was so funny. I'm not even kidding. And it was innovative. You know, you know, they're young people, but you can't afford current music. But I always felt, even on Rude Awakening, that the TV music, like when you hire a composer, doesn't sound like any music anyone listens
to. Right,
So we were able to work out these deals with these up-and-coming bands to use their music in the show, and then had a CD card. It was like no one had ever done that before. My friend, who is super into music, Jack Rudy, and is also a lawyer, would come up with these deals.
Amazing.
It was great. I mean, it was so much it was seriously the most fun I've ever had. I mean, I've had fun before, but that one seemed like, you know, the lack of money plus real new ideas and just a cast that was, you know, open for everything and a great crew. And we used the a guy who does lighting, who's the DP for Curb.
Uh-huh.
So he was also like able to,
wow.
It was just like, you know, oh
right.
Yeah, we can, just whatever you want. Yeah, we could do this, we could do that. It was really fun. It was really fun.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like, yeah. So the fact that it didn't cost a lot of money.
Yes.
And therefore you didn't have a bunch of people.
No.
Trying to control
it. No, we
it.
Did well too. We got good reviews. It's just business things
right
all fall apart, but it wasn't anything to do with us. And
yeah.
Also, it was a scripted show, and they don't really want that on.
Yeah.
Whatever. It was great. And it was dirty.
Okay, that, like, is that on Hulu? Can I find that?
I don't know if you can find it, but if you go on YouTube, you can,
okay,
you know, one of the actresses put a bunch, Joy Gorham, so her reel is on, so you can see a bunch. She was brilliant. And I mean brilliant. I've never worked with anybody. Wow. I thought she is just an incredible actress. Anyway, so.
Okay, so that there was that.
Yes.
And then.
Oh, you just want me to go through
So, well, I know. We'll do highlights. We're going to do, like.
I worked on War at Home with my brother.
Okay.
It was fun. My half brother is Michael Rappaport.
Yes.
And he was the star of The War at Home. You know, that was on for 2 years. And I that was like another. You know, one of the things that I've realized, which is this is now this career, which I almost like never expected to be having.
Right.
Has been 15 years, been like so long now.
Yeah.
You know, been a long time.
Yeah.
You know, and there's so much uncertainty, sadly. You know, you can't control.
Right, but still does it feel like there's uncertainty? I mean, I have this idea, you're so established at this point.
Well, no, of course there's uncertainty. I mean, my last show, I thought it was being, you know, the morning that we were canceled, I was having conversations with them about who I was going to hire.
I love the show.
Thank you.
I really love the show. And so let's...
So
it was so good.
I have to say, I'm pretty much not over that.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if how long that's going to take.
Yeah,
it was,
this was like
shocking. It was a shock.
Everybody loved the show.
Well, look, not everybody loved the show.
Well, I mean,
but we were on. We really had 6 weeks to be a hit.
Yeah,
and that was it.
Yeah,
and. When we were on with original Modern Families, or really any kind of promotion,
we did
great.
Yeah.
Well, not better.
Yeah.
We did pretty well.
Right.
We did, in fact, I mean, one of our nights when we were on with a repeat of Modern Family, we had better retention, which is important,
yeah.
Than anything that's ever been in that spot. Anything.
Right.
So it was an incredibly rewarding experience,
right?
But and clearly, I mean, we're recording this in the house that I have been living in with my parents,
right?
In the other room, and the doors are opening and closing, and I have so much, so many still stories, and so much affection, and so much emotion invested in the relationship that I have with them, and also. I'm telling you, you know, Claudio, you want to hire this one, you want to hire this one, that day. So it was, and I think it was a hard decision for them, too. I mean, I can't say I think they made the right decision, because I don't think they did.
Right.
But they weren't like, we weren't like, I didn't know leading up to it.
Right,
so I didn't
right.
Have
you
any
had
preparation.
Every belief that it was
yes.
going to, that it was doing
every
well.
Every belief
and then,
that it hadn't quite found its audience yet, but it had a very loyal following. Because
right.
I haven't ever had online response to anything I've done from the public to the degree that I did with that
show.
Well,
yeah, it was so personal. I get, you know, yes, Rude Awakening was personal, but like, so, and so.
Well,
and
that predated the internet. And
yeah.
That was I mean, I love Rude Awakening.
Right.
That was a crass, dirty
right.
show. And
right.
I mean, Bill Maher said it was the dirtiest show on television. And that's.
He knows.
Yeah. You know, it was dirty.
So,
I mean, we were trying to appeal. We had to figure out how to get a topless girl, you know, get a naked girl in every episode. It's hard.
Yeah.
Hard to figure out that.
So How to Live With Your Parents for the Rest of Your Life had been something you had been talking about ever since you moved in, right?
Yes. I pitched it. I was pitching it for 10 years. I had written another version of it for HBO, like, years before that. I had given up. I had.
And so do you think it, because it, if it had been cable and there had been more time to.
Well, I don't know whether it would have been, you know, it's a family show, and I don't know what would be the right. I think it was in the right place.
They just made the wrong choice.
It just did not, couldn't compete
yeah.
with the new shows they have. They liked better.
I felt like all I did was see ads for it and billboards for it.
Yeah, no, it was good, but then when you put us on, you know, it was so late in the season. I mean, it was great to get, and they, there's a bunch of business reasons.
Yeah,
that's fine. And it wasn't like had some big hook or whatever. I don't know. I thought it was, you know, a sweet. I thought it was sweet and funny. That's what I liked about it.
Yeah, I just don't tend to like, I mean, I've never seen Modern Family, I just don't tend to watch shows like that, and I watched it because of you, and I loved it, and
I was
disappointed too, and,
thank you very much.
Yeah, but,
anyway, so the point is, you can't control anything.
Yeah.
You can't control anything. And I like to focus my attention on controllable things.
Yeah.
Things
Smart.
That I can absolutely know will, you know, I can manage. And so, can you pause it for a minute?
This might be kind of funny, though.
Okay.
I'll take my car. I'll be back.
Yeah, don't worry about it. Okay.
I love that.
We were thinking about switching cars.
Switching cars?
Yes, because the parking, because I'm living in, whatever.
But you're moving, you're leaving your
I'm
parents.
Leaving. She take my car and I take hers because maybe hers is easier to park in the parking space at the new condo.
Where she's not going.
No, I would, like, we'd literally switch cars forever.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so she'd take my Ford Fusion and I'd take her Mini Cooper, but I wanted to take it down and see, does this fit in the parking space
right.
better? See, this is what
but
I'm
I just love
about.
That it's your mom that drives the Mini Cooper. Like,
yeah.
I saw that and I go, oh, that's Claudia's car.
No, that's my mom's car.
It's crazy.
That's the least crazy car she's ever had. I mean, she used to have these weird, very low to the ground cars where I go, how are you seeing at the windshield? I mean,
right.
You know, whatever. Look, she's fine. There's never an accident. But, so.
Yeah. This kind of thing goes on.
Oh, well, that's what's,
I
yes,
know.
This kind of thing, like, yes, but many, many things go on. So the only thing you can control are your relationships with the people you work with.
Yeah.
And I get a lot from that. And on The War at Home, even though, whatever the show, blah, 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 but I really made some fantastic friendships in that room that really mean a lot to me. So, you know, that's what I'm saying. It's like,
yeah.
You can only, that's it. That's all.
Well,
that's all you can, bank on. All we have is each other.
Right.
That is real and reliable.
Right.
In a television writing career, in terms of your other writers. They're the only ones.
Right.
And even some of the executives, you know, because we're all sort of in this thing, whatever this thing is, this business, and, you know, it's, you know, those moments or that this or, you know, that time we laughed or that
right.
episode we did. I mean, even and I actually on purpose, which was, you know, another show I really liked. I thought was pretty good.
It was on for a while.
Oh, yeah, the highest rated show they canceled that year. So that seems to be my curse. But no, that was just a season. But I had such a great time on that. I mean, I really did.
Well, it's funny, though, what you were saying is funny, because I was talking to this girl this morning and she was talking about how she went on a date and how, you know, she wasn't in her head about what's going to happen. And it's kind of exactly what you were just saying. It's like, it's actually the same thing with our human relationships as well. It's
yes,
like we, especially alcoholics or whatever, a lot of people who knows, like just are sort of like, okay, well, what does this mean? So is this going to work? So does this mean that this will happen and this will happen? Or as opposed to like, I mean, it, like a business like that, and publishing is not all that different, where you better pick your moment, you better just be having fun while it's happening,
because
there are no guarantees.
It's not like I'm in my head as much as anybody else. I just, you know, at the same time, you know what, like, let's say you're in a bad mood.
Yeah.
Let's say you're depressed.
Yeah.
Okay. Even when you're depressed, you're not depressed
every second.
Right. you know, there's pockets, somebody makes you laugh, you eat a meal you like, you talk to your friend.
Right.
Something happens that is a relief from it. Then generally, if it's me, I remind myself I'm depressed.
Right.
You know? So it's the same thing with being in your head. Like, I'm in my head, you know, and I, if I'm trying to do something, you know, my first thought is some grandiose fantasy of, you know, what I'm going to be, you know, what fabulous thing's going to happen to me and how everyone will say nice things about me.
Right.
And, you know, I'll be this and that'll happen and my picture will be here and then, oh my God, I better make sure the picture's okay.
Right.
And what am I going to wear and blah, 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 you know, all of that. And then, you know, and then real life happens.
Yeah.
And I just try to go, I just try to focus on, like, the actions that I do that I can make an try to do better. That's all.
Right.
You know, when I pitch something, a lot of the times I get, you know, it gets, I don't, it's a, there's a performing aspect to it that makes me very anxious.
Because, which is interesting.
Yes, because of my history.
Yes.
Well, because, you know, 14 bad years of acting will definitely ruin your confidence. And so, and, you know, it was, oh, the stakes and, oh, they'll never buy this.
Yeah.
Usually I think, well, you know what? I don't know if I can sell this, honestly. However, this is going to be the best pitch. My only goal when I go to pitch is to get asked back. For
yeah,
the next one.
Good.
So I just try to focus on...
One day at a time ish.
Yes, you know, what this pitch is, this is all of this show right now. The pitch is all that exists.
Yeah.
It's the only real thing.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
That is the show, is this pitch.
Right.
So I write it all out. I practice it every day. I put a timer on because practicing it makes me anxious because I'm thinking about it.
Yes.
So I put the timer on. I'm going to say this out loud for an hour.
Yeah,
that's the kind
but well, it makes you anxious, but doesn't then it bring it makes you feel calm? I mean, that the fact that you have practiced.
Gee, I don't know if anything makes me feel calm. I usually just, you know, I'm a little bit better about it now. I mean, preparation definitely alleviates nerves, but you know, the thing that's difficult about preparation is that it reminds you of the event.
I know.
I mean, you have to push through it. It's very difficult.
It's weird. I've been recently thinking about this because, you know, I have this storytelling show that I've been trying to get you to come to, and I will one day succeed.
Yeah.
And for a long time,
do you have to write the story, or just
you
tell
can just
the story?
Tell it if you want.
Do people do that?
I think
I would write it.
Well, it's very much what we're talking about.
Yeah.
So I sort of had this idea, and I used to have this idea when I would go on hosting auditions that like a talented person should be able to wing it. And it was also some weird fear of success kind of a thing. And so I was trying to wing it and it was not going well. And then I realized, oh my God, I really have to practice and I have to do that thing that I'm self-conscious about doing, which is like in a room alone, maybe I'm recording myself and feeling like a cliche, mm-hmm. you know, and that actually makes it, it sounds so obvious, it makes it go well.
Oh, yeah.
I thought there was something weak or lame or cliched about preparation for things like that. It meant you weren't talented or something.
Yeah, I've stories I've done them before, but for Sit and Spin.
Yeah, it's like
right?
Sit and Spin. Oh my God, I saw Jill Soloway's movie last night.
It's fantastic.
Oh my God.
Isn't it fantastic?
Oh my God.
Yeah, she's my spirit animal right now.
I just, yeah, she, I raved about it on Twitter and she started following me. I was like, yes!
Yeah,
yes!
No, she's great.
I mean, a genius.
I know, it's fantastic. That story is great. You should interview her.
Yeah,
she got that together was amazing.
Oh, yeah, I don't know, but it was just, afterwards I just sat there in the theater just going, that was so good, that was so good,
know,
that was so good.
The performances are incredible.
Storytelling, and I know you've done storytelling, and also I loved your Kindle single, I kind of thought would be good stories.
Yeah, well, those came from the stories I've done.
The Sit and Spin.
The Sit and Spin.
Right.
Yes, those came from that.
Yeah.
You know, which all, like recently I did Ask Cat at UCB.
I've never seen that. I'm dying to see that.
Oh my God, you've got to go.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
one of the guys who does it was on How to Live, who I discovered. He's her boss friend.
Okay.
Joe Wenger. He's so talented. Anyway, so I thought, you know what? I'm not going to do my normal stories. I'll just improvise. And I got up there, and the first one, I was like, well, this is really hard. So the second time, whatever word they said, I moved it to a story I was familiar with.
So it's like improv storytelling or something?
Yes.
Yeah,
it's really hard.
Yeah.
I would want to do it again. I thought about, like, I don't have any time, and I don't know why I would do this, but, well, I do know why. I thought, well, maybe you should take some improv classes.
That's what I want to do. That's what I want to do.
Yeah.
Because I feel like it's good
anything
for this.
Anything is good.
With that, especially, it's like, you know, and I actually looked into it, and I was so close that I went to the thing, and then the one I could do was full, but they have new ones all the time.
Yeah, they do. It's like, you know, like, having done even not fantastically, I never felt stand up has helped me in so many situations.
Tell me about your stand up bit. Is the part of you I do not know about this?
Well, you know,
the improv?
Oh, I did it on and off. The first time I went on was at the New York Improv when I was 15.
Oh my God.
Because, you know, I was already doing whatever, you know, like teenage. I went to that. Did you go see the movie Camp?
Yes.
Okay.
But
I went
to that camp.
I went to the camp with the guy who wrote the movie.
Right.
Camp.
Of course he did. That was an amazing movie.
It was great, and camp was amazing. And I took acting classes from the crazy Cuban dude who was the acting guru. It was so insane. The 70s. I mean,
right.
Boy, I really. You know, these kids today, they just don't know what danger is. They just don't know what danger is.
And yet we're more concerned. Because you grew up in New York.
Yes.
Not here at all.
Not here.
You were in New York.
I moved out here when I was 15.
Okay.
So, in any case, I had gone back to New York to visit my dad and for Christmas and, you know, take my guitar with me, whatever. And I called up... you know, because I was just like, you know, you've got to always be. That's the family I grew up in. It's
right.
Just constant, you know, ambitious drive.
Right, right.
And
I grew
so,
up similarly.
Yes, I called the dude who managed the improv, who later went on to run HBO, Chris Albrecht, and I used to babysit his then girlfriend's kids when my parents did improv in Manhattan before we moved, and said, can I do audition night? So I, you know, went on. I sang a song that I had written with my guitar, which was like my big high school song, called Fuck the World. And it starts out really sweet. So, you know, I got a lot of laughs. And then...
So it's like Simon and... it's like...
Yes.
What are their names? What are their names?
Simon and Oates or Oates and Garfunkel.
Yeah, they're so great.
Yes. Yeah, it was like that.
Okay.
Yes, I guess it was like that.
You were the precursor.
Yes.
Ahead of your time yet again.
And so, and then I had, and then, so I was always kind of working or, and then my stepfather had the improv out here while I was doing Knots Landing. My friend and I had an act that was like the singing.
Okay.
More singing. And you know, so I would do in and out of doing stand-up. Then I really got like 5 minutes, you know, then I really got just mostly talk. Then I had a single act, which was all mostly singing.
What was a single act?
You know, by myself.
Oh,
I had a double act previously. And so then I was doing myself original songs, which... some big manager told me it was terrible. And
comedic original
comedic,
songs,
very
right?
Very comedic.
Okay.
And then, so he was like, you know, this is terrible. And you're not going anywhere with this. And so then I came up with a, you know, an act, which was never great.
Okay.
I have to say it was never great. But I got... better at performing it.
Right, and comfortable.
Well, I mean, I did. I had this, I worked in Arizona at Knucklehead. I mean, I had a week in Arizona. That was so awful. I was following a guy who was much better than me, and also voices and singing and, you know, voices and stuff.
But you had someone booking this all for you, like a...
I think you have to do it mostly yourself.
Okay, okay.
But
you got yourself.
I had people. Yeah. You know, I don't know what I did. It's just kind of a cobbling together of things.
Yes.
I'm following this guy, and he was from Arizona. Anyway, he would decimate real crowd pleaser. Then I'd go on.
Yeah.
And I'm the feature, which means 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And you can't get off stage before the 30 minutes are done, even if you're dying, or they won't pay you.
Yeah.
So I would go, eight shows, whatever it was that week, died every time. I was calling my mother and doing her act. I was calling every other female.
Would the crowd respond at all?
They hated me. I mean, literally. I had a drink thrown at me. It was terrible. And then the second week of that booking, I followed a normal opening act, and so I did
well.
I mean, I killed, and I did great in Minnesota.
Okay.
You know, but the main thing is when I would go into a pitch, when I went into shows, I said, well, no one's going to throw a drink at you.
Yeah.
How bad could it be?
Well, and you had all this, that was all preparation to sell the show when you hadn't, you know.
Yes.
Well, it's like, it's funny because I always say that, like, my training for everything is actually meetings. I'd never spoken in public. I'd never thought I was funny. And then, like, I was in meetings, and, like, people started to laugh at what I said. And I was like, and that kind of gave me the confidence to do it on television. And then with writing books, it was like, I can't write a book. Are you kidding me? And then I'm like, but one day at a time, I could write 3 pages, I guess.
Right.
But so I feel like, and then this live show, I booked all these really funny women, like super funny, super talented at the top of their game. And for about 10 shows, I had to be the worst one. Because they were so good. And I was like, oh my God, I'm the girl that people go, oh yeah, we have to listen to her because she created the show. And it's like, I finally kind of got past that point, and now I feel like I'm not that person.
You're not.
But I had to go through that in order to get to the next.
I felt like it was so funny because during the 14 bombing years of my life where I just felt like, you know the comic Taylor Negron?
Yeah.
He had a joke in his act, which was, I was a Hare Krishna for 20 blocks, and then I said, it's taking too long. And that was how I felt. I felt, this is taking so long. I mean, I don't think I'm going to live long enough for this to pay off. But then I realized in retrospect, things turned out well, that whole time,
was
especially
building.
For Rude Awakening, I was creating a character.
Right.
By talking in meetings.
Right.
About myself.
Right.
And at a certain point, the humiliation, started to feel funny to me.
Yeah.
It started to seem comedic that all of the things that were so difficult seemed, well, that's ridiculous. I mean, it's so funny.
At the time, or only once they passed.
Well, you get laughs at meetings.
Yeah,
and,
that's the thing.
But after time, I was like, I kind of came up with I think it's funny. You know, bad things happening to people is funny.
Yeah.
And especially, I did. I thought it was funny. I mean, at one point I was a temp, and I'm delivering packages. I was scared to drive on the freeway. I mean, I felt really good about myself that I found the places.
Right, right. Well, I still feel like
But I'm like driving for 2 hours in this broken down car. And then all of that, I worked at I did a lot of things.
Well, it's, yeah. So when I start to be like, oh, she's had this blessed life, I can refer to, I know, but it's like, it's just funny how we write other stories
I'm happy that people think that.
Well, because I'm like, not Leanne, she was this glamorous, like, she got to do that as, like, you know, a young woman in there, and she just creates show after show, you know, but it never feels like that when you're in it,
no,
you know?
I was the chubby teenager on Knox Landing.
Now you are doing what?
Now I'm working on Sean Saves the World, starring Sean Hayes.
Great. I've seen the posters.
Which is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Great. He's fantastic.
Yeah.
He's got a great cast. Linda Lavin, Tom Lennon.
Who's the funniest person alive.
I think he is a genius.
Yeah.
Megan Hilty. this new kid who's kid, everybody's a kid,
yeah,
come out of UCB named Echo Kellum, who's really great. And you know, and I'm not developing anything this year. But you know, I'm right. I've always got a bunch of things.
So are you, do you go in, you're on the staff, you,
yes,
you're a consultant? Okay, you go,
yeah,
in.
No, I'm a co-EP.
Co-EP.
Which is a,
but that's writing for...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The upper-level writers are...
Called
all
producers.
Have producers.
Yeah.
Yes, you go in every day.
Yeah. Writer's room that we
writer's
hear about.
Writer's room. There's a writer's room, and you have your office, and you break stories, and then you have run-throughs. It's a multicam.
Right.
Which... I, you know, it's funny. I think I personally, I find single camera more fun to write. It's more fun to write. You know, the jokes are, can be, you know, you're, it's just, I don't know, subtler. Or, you know, different.
Yeah.
You know, the camera picks up things. It's just a different thing. Some of it. And, but multicam is fun to work on. I mean, you're doing a live show. It's fun. It's exciting. It is fun. There's an audience. It's really fun. I don't
right.
know how. I don't know what the formula is to make it cool for, you know, people who write on the internet or review things anymore.
Right.
It seems
right.
like sort of impossible. But
yeah.
as an experience to be on, it's really fun.
Well, and is it nice without all the pressure of
yes.
your here's your life on television
well,
and you could get the rug pulled out from
oh
under
you.
Oh my God.
You know, it's I have to say, it's like when things come up, I think, oh, that's the kind of thing I would be really anxious about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
My
I,
show.
I would imagine.
And now it's like, well, whatever, you know.
Yeah.
I don't have the same burden. I mean,
yeah.
You know, I mean, when you're running a show, there's, you know, the upside is that aside from your business partners of the network and the studio, you know, there is, you do feel like there's, you know, you're making a lot of decisions.
Yeah.
You know, you really are.
Yeah.
You have the capacity to make a bunch of decisions, and that is gratifying and creatively fulfilling.
Right.
On the other hand, when you're in the room, if someone is walking towards the room, they're coming to talk to you.
Yeah.
They're not coming to talk to anybody else.
Yeah.
So it's you're really
overwhelming.
I mean, one of the things I did this panel at the WGA, and well, actually, I think my boyfriend came up with this phrase. It's like you were a writer, and now all of a sudden you're running a 7-Eleven. I mean, you're the president of a business.
Yeah.
And you go from like a kind of isolated existence, or you know, of writing,
where
to,
you don't really matter that much.
Yeah, well, you're
or
in your office
yeah.
writing a script
yeah.
to. You know, prop
running
people
show.
Showing you
yeah.
this and
yeah.
costumes. You've got to pick the costumes and the locations and approve a set. I
right.
mean, you know.
Right.
And, you know, when I was doing Rude, you know, there were things that I knew subconsciously from having, you know, been on a show
right.
and grown up in show business, but there were other things.
Yeah.
I
had no idea was part of the job.
Well, I didn't know. I didn't even know that was part of my job.
Yeah.
I mean, we had one right at the beginning. Right at the beginning, watching a cut of the first or second episode. And what the director did on that, I did not realize that I didn't care for.
Right.
Because I really didn't even know. But we're cutting it together, and one of the lines, there's no camera on the...
The person saying it.
There's no... face of the woman saying one of my favorite lines in the script.
Right.
And I'm in the editing room with the executive from Showtime, who we're looking for the footage, and I'm just sort of sitting there, and she goes, Claudia, you're supposed to look for that. And I thought to myself, oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I was just sitting there giving performance notes.
Right, right, right. Oh,
but I didn't know. I am looking at the camera
yeah.
to make sure we have a shot. We have the shots.
Right.
They're,
right.
Now they're supposed to be. It was a interesting dynamic for those particular episodes.
Because shouldn't the director also be?
Well, there's a woman there that's supposed to keep
right.
track of that as well. But he was a dick.
Okay.
So
yeah.
she
wasn't
could,
there.
She couldn't say anything to him.
Right.
And she was worried about telling me because she didn't want to get in trouble. It was just
right.
like, and I didn't even
and,
know.
Yeah.
Now, from then on, I went, oh, I'm like
yeah,
writing
yeah, yeah,
down everything.
Yeah.
You know, we need a close-up of her.
Right.
You know, we need a fucking single of her.
Right.
You know, but I didn't know. I mean, yeah. I didn't know.
Ugh.
I mean, the second day of shooting the first episode of Rude Awakening, I'm in the writer's room, and we're talking and, you know, whatever, and I'm facing the window and I'm going, wow, it's so weird that the light is, like, it's all fuzzy or something. Well, let me switch places with you. So we switch places and I'm looking at, you know, Andrea and Pam Mills, who was our, you know, supervising me, because, you know.
Yeah.
Because, and I'm going, wow, it's still, wow,
okay.
You know, I mean, my vision is screwed up in my eye. You know what, I'm going to go down to my office and lie down. We're, you know, we're going to shoot soon.
Yeah.
Like, I lie down on the, I'm in my office, and it's continuing on, and I start to get a panic going, you know, am I having a stroke? What is happening? I can't leave everybody.
Yeah.
This is depending on me. Now I'm lying on the floor, flipping out.
Was it a migraine?
All of a sudden, I remembered my mother telling me stories about when she would get a migraine and wind up lying on the floor. And it was my first migraine.
Oh, God.
And I had to, I mean, then the pain started.
Yeah, yeah,
I
yeah.
had to go to the set. It was just like...
Oh, you went through... Oh.
What am I going to do?
I don't know.
There's only
I've
three
had...
people on staff.
Right, right, right.
You know, we three people on staff and with a crazy schedule. I mean, I had to go.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
Oh, God. I've had, like, whatever, 10 in my life, and it's basically, like...
Well, thank God for Imitrex.
I don't. What is that? I just take Advil and go and lie in bed.
Oh my God!
What? There is this a prescription medication?
Yes. Here, I'm not gonna give it to you.
Oh my God! Well, okay.
You get the inhaler.
Inhaler.
Yeah.
So okay, it's a nasal thing.
A nasal spray. As soon as you feel it.
Yeah.
Up the
I don't
nose.
Get the light. Is the thing. What I get is just a pain back here,
mm-hmm.
and then pretty soon I'm like. Nauseous and think I'm dying. It was as soon as I'm like, oh God, I have to go to the hospital, and then I wake and then I fall asleep eventually, and I wake up in the morning and I think I imagine the whole thing.
Yeah, no, get
okay.
Get a prescription.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, good to know. Who knew I was getting medical advice? Okay, and so regarding sobriety, you are how long sober now?
28 years.
Jesus Christ.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
More years than you drank.
Well, way more years
yeah.
than I was alive.
Yeah, because so okay, and it was like, it was cocaine and alcohol.
It was. I mean, the thing that I would say, the thing that really turned me into an addict and an alcoholic was cocaine.
Yeah.
Prior to that, I would call myself. I don't know whether it was on the road to a problem. It was
right.
I was a weekend person.
And then what happened with cocaine?
I wanted to, well, I was, as I said, I was the chubby girl on television.
Cocaine never got me thin.
Oh my God, I got so thin.
You
I mean, I got too thin.
Okay.
And I had easy access
yeah.
to it without implicating any particular people, but
right.
I had very easy access.
One could assume you would anyway, given where you were.
And I was a daily
yeah.
user.
Just snorting it. You weren't like
just
shooting
it
and smoking it.
And at a certain point doing that, just mostly cocaine, and I tried whatever was the crystal
yes.
meth at the time, I did not care for it.
I did not care for it either.
But I got to a critical point.
Okay.
And, you know, of really bad. And then I pulled back and I started drinking, which
right.
seemed to balance it out. And I have to say that this entire thing, this whole episode of this part of my life took about 2 to 3 years.
Yeah.
And the progression from the progression of alcoholism happened in an incredibly short amount of time.
Yeah, that's my experience.
Because
too.
I'm not entirely sure why, if it's chemical or what to tell you.
Right.
But my capacity for alcohol was so high because of the cocaine.
Yeah.
And then I had my, I guess I've never really understood the Eskimo thing, but I had my experience where I was at the Improv again, but mm-hmm. during the day, which I never did. I was mm-hmm. with some dude I had met mm-hmm. named Robot, or Robbit or something. I didn't even like him. And I said, well, let's just go to the Improv and get some coffee. And all these people started coming out of the showroom. And then I saw a friend of mine who was not just my doppelganger at the time. She was dating the guy I used to date, and she she played a teenager on a nighttime soap opera for the same company.
Okay.
So she was playing the part I played on another show.
At that time she
at
was
that
playing?
Time.
Okay. That's crazy.
You know, I would watch that show sometimes and they would do old storylines that we had done. And I'm like, what's happening? Is this an acting class? And she said, no, it's a 12-step meeting.
Right.
I'm an alcoholic. And I'm like, wow, really? And what? And,
right.
You know, every Thursday at 12:30 and blah, blah, blah. And then she leaves and I go, well, I've hung out with her. I mean,
right.
I'm way worse than she is. She doesn't know half the shit I do. If she's got a problem, I know I have a problem. And I knew I was addicted to cocaine.
Yeah.
I mean, there was no question about
that. Yeah,
And then I wasn't on the show anymore, and the money for cocaine was not
coming in.
And I literally realized, I didn't realize how much I was drinking until I wasn't doing coke anymore.
Yeah, I relate to that.
I had a blackout.
I
had one experience where I drank, it seems hard to believe at this point, but I drank a bottle of vodka.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know,
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, an entire bottle.
Yeah, and didn't feel anything.
God, I had very similar experiences.
And I was just like, I'm not
able. It's like you can't
get
drunk enough. Yeah.
No, I
couldn't
even.
I get it. I get it.
I said, I just feel depressed, but I do not feel drunk.
Drunk, yeah.
And this is so fattening.
Right.
On top of everything
else.
I mean, it really looked not good at the time.
Right.
And I was still going to the Improv every night. And, you know, I had confrontations with my stepfather.
About drugs?
Yes, about drugs.
You were living with them?
No.
You were not?
I went into why you would continue to go to your parents' club when you clearly have a problem,
right.
I don't know.
Right,
besides the fact that I was able to get the drinks for free.
Okay. Yeah, no, so it was a setup. So you're getting the drugs. He's saying, I know you're doing drugs.
He said, what are you going to do about the fact that you're a cokehead?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, cry.
Yeah.
And so going every night, and on Wednesday nights would come, and I think, you know what, I should go to that meeting tomorrow. And then didn't make it. And then one Wednesday night, I was partying with another teenage actress who also got sober. Eventually, and I'm bumming her blow, and I've drunk like six Courvoisiers. I didn't feel nothing.
Right.
And I said, I am going to that meeting tomorrow. And for whatever reason, gullible, I am a gullible person.
Me too.
Except for some things, but whatever. If I believed, I thought, well, you go there and they do it for you.
Right.
I absolutely believed it would work.
I had absolutely no question
in my mind.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I was kind of the same way. Yeah.
None. It never occurred to me that this wasn't going to work.
Yeah.
Or that I'd have to do anything.
Right.
I thought I would just go. And when I went to my first meeting, you know, I thought, I mean, I'm Jewish. I thought it was a Christian cult.
Yeah.
And the God crap. I was just like, I had no idea that would be a part of it.
Right.
And people's bottoms were so much worse than
mine. Right.
However, I mean, their physical bottom.
Right.
But my emotional bottom
yep.
was so bad, but that wasn't it. It was that people talked about feeling like they never fit in. I always feel weird, you know, I always feel like, you know, I always feel like I'm pretending or I, you know, they don't know what to say to people.
Yeah.
And that they had, you know, whatever, a black empty hole.
Right.
And I had been complaining about this to my parents, my mom specifically.
Right.
I don't know how to talk to people. I can't make friends. I don't fit in. I don't feel like other people. I mean, my whole life.
Wow.
My whole life. And I just went, well, I guess this is why. I mean, right. I literally went, well,
right.
this seems like a reasonable, this
right.
seems like an answer.
Right.
And I'd never heard anybody talk
yeah.
about that before.
Yeah.
And even though I, you know, was very, really didn't, I didn't see how there was ever going to be a way that I would ever have a spiritual, you know, it didn't
right.
even occur to me. I mean, it did, I had something, but I did it. In that meeting, I said, you know, to myself, God, I don't know if there is a God, but if there is, I can't stop drinking and doing cocaine. Help me. And I never did cocaine again.
Yeah.
And then, and it took me a while to get, oh, you can't smoke pot on a Sunday.
Right.
Or something at your, you know, you can't steal your,
no.
somebody's pot and smoke it. And then, but I didn't even, I mean, that was after the fact. Oh, yeah, that's the right. I smoked pot that one time.
Yeah.
I couldn't, my sobriety date is a little, I'm not sure. Let's pick this date.
Right.
Because I wasn't keeping track, and I didn't really go, you know, I just went to the one meeting. And then after a while, I went, well, you know, if you're going to do this.
Maybe more than once a week and
yes,
do
I was,
the whole thing.
I became like a total lunatic about it.
Oh, you did? See, I missed those years of you.
Yeah, I couldn't talk about anything else.
Oh, yeah. I'm worried I'm still in those years myself. Did the girl who was the inspiration Eskimo woman, did she stay around? Did you
oh, yeah.
Oh, she's still around?
Mm-hmm.
Good for her.
Oh, yeah.
And so then you got super into it, and then you got less into it, and now you are where you are.
Yeah, I have an incredible very strong foundation.
Yeah.
And, you know, I really did the work.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I very much did.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think at a certain point, you know, I got to a place where it's like every single thing about me made me be here, so I'm getting rid of every single thing about me. And at a certain point, I went, you don't have to get rid of every single thing about you.
What do you mean, like qualities?
Qualities, everything. I mean, a lot of things that I considered part of who I was, I
thought you had to get rid of.
Yes. And then, I mean, like, way into it, like, really about the time, you know, I guess in my 30s, I went, oh, you know, I really miss all the people I used to like. And,
right.
you know, I can meet friends with the people. I hadn't
right.
seen people, you know, and I was embarrassed. I mean, I was very embarrassed because I had kind of grown up with a bunch of people at the club.
Right.
When I was doing so well. And then I felt like I lost, you know, I really felt ashamed.
Right.
And so I stayed away from a lot of people.
So the shame, did that have to do with being like an addict, you mean, or just...
I felt like a loser. I mean,
right.
I felt like I had been very successful and then I was a failure.
Right. And
so, you know, it was embarrassing.
Right.
So I kind of cut, you know, everyone out of my life, except for people in the program.
And yeah.
Then, you know, once I left my husband, I started to, you know, go, well, you know, hey, remember how you used to
right.
be so full of yourself? I mean, that's something. It's supposed to be.
Right.
You could be a little full of yourself, you know? I mean.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of feel like you're, yeah, I mean.
I was so young when I came in.
Yeah.
I mean, I was, really impressionable.
Yeah, and took things to an extreme, it sounds like.
I did. I had never... I mean, I don't think I had ever dedicated myself to something as intently.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got so much out of overcoming my own sloth that I really, you know...
Felt like you had to do it to the extreme.
Yeah, I really learned how to do things I didn't want to do.
Yeah.
I mean, that was almost the entire basis of every single thing about being sober for me.
That's interesting. I mean, I really relate to the, well, to the cutting off people. Yeah.
Just looking.
How are we doing on time?
We're fine.
You're just... being so good and giving me so much, and I'm so grateful, but we are coming to an end.
Okay.
Not at all. But maybe we should, I had like all these things that I never even went to, because we just naturally came to it. But, okay, there is a question from Twitter that I take every week.
Yes.
This one is from SamSax_0909. The question is, how can someone who's chosen to remain sober for 20 years lose that power of choice if they relapse? He had 140 characters. I feel like what he's saying is, like that, you know, which is something I feel like people who are sober and in program or whatever talk about a lot. Like, the reason that we can't go, like, smoke pot on Sundays with whoever or have a drink is that it sort of sets off that phenomenon of craving.
Right.
I think that's what he's actually, I'm pretty sure that's what he's talking about. Any thoughts on that? Well, like, you choose at 28 years to not go, like, have a drink right now.
Yes.
Because?
Well, look, some of it is habit.
Mm-hmm.
I have developed a new habit.
Yeah.
And I am a habitual person.
Yeah.
Which is what made me an addict.
Right.
I'm afraid. I don't want to lose what I have.
Right.
Not even just in terms of material things, because, you know, look, I got sober so young. There's definitely a part of me that goes, oh, you know, who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows?
Maybe it was a phase.
You know, Drew Barrymore, she had a phase.
Yeah.
Whatever, but, you know, she's functional. Maybe you'd be functional or something.
Right.
Maybe it was just the cocaine. So, right. I mean, and especially with pot being around so much, I would say that and I don't even remember if I loved pot, but there was one thing I did love about pot. I loved watching reruns on pot because I just loved it so much. Hang out, but you know, there's a thing about the nostalgia of something you're familiar with and being an adult and the drug on top of it.
Yeah.
I thought that was fantastic.
Right.
But, you know, but I'm afraid of losing whatever it is I have inside. And I also feel that I want to protect the faith that I have in the program.
Right.
Because I might need it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my faith in a specific higher power is a thing that is not as literal as some other people's, but my faith in the program is very strong.
Right.
And I don't want to tear away at it by destroying it.
Yeah.
So, and it means so much to me that I, you know, and I mean, look, I mean, it occurs to me every once in a while, and I go, oh, God, it could happen so easily.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, what if I did it right now? And I used to have a real panic about that, so I almost don't like to talk about it.
Right.
But, But I, the desire's been taken away.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't that what's supposed to happen?
It happened to me.
So
weird.
And I don't know. And the other thing is, how would this possibly be enjoyable to me at this point?
You've sat in too many.
How can
meetings.
I enjoy?
Yeah.
This.
Yeah.
Knowing.
Right.
What
could be possible.
Lost.
Yeah.
How could I possibly? I don't even think it would. It would be good. Now I will tell you.
Yeah.
That this is a terrible thing to say.
Go ahead. Okay.
About what I'm about to say.
Okay. Go ahead.
I do fantasize sometimes about getting cancer, because then I feel like all bets are off.
To say. That's a terrible thing to say.
Or then, something else.
Wow.
I go, well, that'd be great. I mean, then nobody would get mad at me.
No, they would say, can we bring you your marijuana?
I would be, it seems like the only upside.
Oh, God. Well, I'll tell
you. But even then, I worry, would I enjoy it?
You wouldn't.
Because I'd be so anxious about the cancer.
You wouldn't.
I mean, this is alcoholic thinking to the max.
It is.
I am
is.
Being 100%
yeah, no,
honest.
And I love the honesty. I will tell you that I had this terrible pain and we're totally done, but like I had sciatica that was so bad that I had to take morphine.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's bad.
It was the worst experience of my life. I wanted to die taking morphine. And I think it was just this like being so shut off from, it was fun. It was like the free lapse.
Oh yeah, I bet that was so great.
For like 3 days, the most fun. Then it was hell.
3 days. Because any pain thing I've had where I've taken pain medication, which thankfully I don't enjoy.
Yeah. Well, but to me,
but
I did enjoy.
But morphine would be great.
No. Well, I did enjoy.
I'm just saying, because I've never done that.
Yeah.
But whatever, you know, it's codeine or blah, blah, head surgery or, you know, and I have muscle spasms. But
right.
You know what? I feel great for about 5 minutes. It doesn't work on me.
Yeah.
Besides,
it doesn't. Oh, it doesn't relieve the pain. It didn't really.
Oh, no, it relieves. It doesn't make me.
High.
Yes.
Right.
5 minutes of this is fantastic.
You mean because you think it is working or it does make you high for 5 minutes?
No, it makes me high for 5 minutes.
Okay.
And then, then it wears off. I want to take another one.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's just not a, I don't get any.
Yeah.
I can't get anything out.
Well, I think, yeah. I wish not cancer on you. And, I adore you. You're my idol.
Thanks.
Sorry.
Thank
that's
you.
A weird thing to say. And people can find you on Twitter.
Yes, they
can. Of course.
At Claudia Lana.
And when does the show premiere?
In October.
Okay.
And I don't know the date.
Okay.
It's on NBC Thursday nights at 9.
Okay. I'll be watching.
Okay.
I can't set the DVR yet. Well, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you so much, sweetie.